happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Thank you, John, for letting us use your music. Today on the show, you guys are in for a treat. In fact, for the next month or so, you guys are in for a treat because I am unveiling all sorts of surprises on this podcast for you. I'll get to that later, though. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Aaron Draplin down in Portland, Oregon. He is arguably one of the most influential people in graphic design alive today. He is also absolutely hilarious. You guys are going to love this. Aaron has designed everything from concert posters to album covers to book covers to magazines to logos, a lot of logos over the years. He even has a U.S. postage stamp that is in circulation right now that he designed. He put out a book a year or two ago called Pretty Much Everything that I highly recommend. It's crammed with his work philosophy, his design philosophy, all sorts of sketches and work examples, as well as some music stuff. He is also the founder of Field Notes, which are these slick little flexible notebooks that you've probably seen where you can jot down whatever it is that you need to jot down. I should add, I know you guys are all guitar nerds. They fit pretty well in any guitar case pocket, and you can write down set lists or chords or, if you're really anal, whenever you change your strings or whatever, Field Notes, look those up. Why am I talking to Aaron Draplin today? Because in addition to all of the design stuff that we just talked about, he is a huge music person and guitar person. On his Instagram page, he has been showing his guitars off for a while. I know he did some work for our buddy Saul Cole, refining Saul's logo on his guitar headstocks, and a bunch more. Like, Aaron's just a kindred spirit. I think you're going to really enjoy this podcast. I had no idea that we were basically exactly the same age. We shared all sorts of commonalities in our music background. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you guys also agree with me that this was a good one. I will say up front, Aaron doesn't mince words. This is an unfiltered conversation. So if by some odd chance you punish your kids by making them listen to the Fretboard Journal podcast every week, maybe skip this episode. There's some swearing that goes on. I'm sorry. We don't like to edit those things out because we want to capture the essence of these people that we are interviewing. For the rest of you, though, I think you're going to like this conversation. Before we get to this conversation, though, gotta give a few shout-outs to our sponsors. First up, they're back, our pals at Retrofret in New York City. And guess what? They moved. I think that's why they went dark on us for a while. They were busy packing boxes and stuff. I know how that feels. They left their funky space in Brooklyn that took one or two bus lines and a long hike to get to. You had to explain to your wife why you were walking and going so far away from Manhattan when you were on vacation to see Retrofret, to Carroll Gardens, an incredible neighborhood in New York City. They just had a solo Bill Frisell concert that looked incredible. I'm pretty sure they have a Michael Daves and Friends concert happening in October that I wish I could be at. I was just talking to my friend Larry about how some guitar stores have feng shui and some do not. Some of them you walk into and you just want to grab a guitar, and some you're just like, get me the hell out of here. Retrofret has that feng shui, that X factor. I don't know how to describe it. I should write about this. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But whenever I've gone to Retrofret, I immediately feel at home. I want to sit down. I want to play something. And right now they have some incredible instruments for sale that I definitely want to play. They have a Kalamazoo Model 2 amp. I'm pretty sure that's the same amp that Blake Mills took. He brought two of them to the Fretboard Summit, the first one that we ever did. They also have a Harmony H44 Stratotone, speaking of Blake Mills, from 1953 for sale right now. I know a lot of you guys out there have been looking for those. They have one that looks amazing. They also have one of my favorite acoustic guitar designs of all time, a 16-inch L5. This one's from 1935, available right now. Everything they have is great, though. Go to retrofret.com, get lost for an hour or two, seeing all that they have in store. And by all means, Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. I also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Roberto Venn in Phoenix, Arizona. For 40 years now, they've been teaching people how to become luthiers, how to work on guitars. So many people in the factories that I've met at all the big companies, whenever I tour them, have come from Roberto Venn, and you could go there too. They have both a 10-week program that teaches you the ins and outs of being a guitar tech or guitar repair person. You could pretty much get a job wherever you want after you take that course. They also have shorter things. They have weekend-long courses on how to build an amp or guitar setup or pickup winding or you name it. Go to roberto-venn.com to see their entire lineup of events. So glad they want to be a part of the Fretboard Journal podcast. It means the world to us. Thank you guys at Roberto Venn. All right. I hinted that we have some surprises in store for you this month. Here is what's going on. The Fretboard Journal has just launched its first ever subscription drive for the month of September 2019. As a reader-supported magazine, subscriptions are truly our lifeblood. I've said that before on this show. I'll say it again. They keep the lights on. For 15 years now, we've been putting out this magazine. Our postage costs have gone up. Our printing costs have gone up. All of our costs have gone up. Meanwhile, I've tried to keep our subscription and our newsstand prices the same. And I've done that because I want you guys to be able to discover these stories and tell your friends about these stories as easily and as affordably as possible. I have no intention of going out of business. A lot of print magazines have. Advertising dries up. The model dies. I want to show the world that this model, reader-supported, niche, fan base that's passionate about the subject matter, guitars, come on people, guitars, amazing handmade guitars. I want to show the world that this model can work, and so far it has. The easiest way to support us is if everybody just went to fretboardjournal.com and got a digital subscription for 1 year. It's $30. You get 5 issues of the Fretboard Journal, a year's worth plus of magazines, 128 pages each. You're going to be immersed in amazing stories and photography from around the world about fretted instruments. But we have other perks as well. We have exclusive t-shirts. We have packages where you can get a subscription, a t-shirt, and an exclusive set of strings from Straight Up Strings. We have all sorts of stuff over on fretboardjournal.com. Check it out. And here's what I'm going to do in return as a thank you for you in advance subscribing to us. All month long, we're going to be sharing some pretty amazing and maybe unlikely chats on this podcast. This is one of them, chatting with Aaron Draplin. Who knew? We also have some FJ favorites coming back. TJ Thompson's going to be on this podcast. I'll be grilling him about Martin Repair and Charo and all sorts of other stuff. We have some new videos we're going to be sharing on fretboardjournal.com that you've never seen, including, yes, yet another solo Bill Frisell track recorded here at the Fretboard Journal. Bill has been such an amazing supporter to this magazine over the years, and a lot more. If any of this stuff resonates with you, if any of the podcasts that we produce have had an impact on you, we've turned you on to incredible guitar makers or people or anything that you've talked to your friends about, please support us if you haven't yet. I know a lot of you have supported us, and I cannot thank you guys enough. It means the world to me. But for everybody else out there who has been eagerly digesting this show but has never supported us or subscribed to the magazine, I hope you'll do so in some small way or big way. It would mean the world to us. All right, I've rambled enough. Fretboard Journal Subscription Drive 2019 is underway. Kicking it off with Aaron Draplin. I hope you enjoy this chat. Thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
All right, man, a little bit intimidating, a little bit.
You are...
Well, I mean, you have, like, guitar players. You have, like, people who can play guitar, like, icons in your magazine. And I learn a song and I forget it just as fast. Embarrassing, yeah.
You are, you probably don't want to be described this way, but you probably are one of the, if not the most famous designer alive today, right? I mean... You've done logos. You've got field notes.
I don't know about that,
Ted. Yeah,
that's really fun to talk about. Thank you, I appreciate that. But I know, I mean, here, you know, let me just embrace my narcissistic side for a second. Of course, I mean, sure. I mean, when I go to the airport, man, here in Portland or anywhere, kids stop me and their hands are shaking, and that is such an incredible privilege and such a weird thing, and that's happening. But I know how to handle it. You know, I know how to, like, calm them down. I pull out some stickers or field notes or something out of my bag and say, hey, I'm just a person. You're impressed? Fuck, help me with my bags. I'm tired of lugging all this merch around. And by the way, off the record, you ought to see me at any of these customs deals, me smuggling all that shit across. Oh, man, it is gross. Okay, back in the on the record. Yeah, fame is such, what does that even mean? First of all, it's such a niche. And second of all, what I would just hope, whatever perception, I would disagree with kind of what you said, because you know that's kind of a, if someone actually says they are, who the kind of fucking person, yeah. Are we allowed to swear in this thing?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, what kind of person would actually even acknowledge that? But I can say this much: anyone who meets me, I would hope I'm the same gorilla on a podcast as I would be when they meet me, if that makes sense, right? You know, I mean, this isn't an act. This is me, and hopefully I'm from a nice person on a podcast. I'd be a nice person, in the airport when they meet me and realize I'm just a guy trying to smuggle shit across the border, you know, sure. Something like that. So,
well, one of the reason that I wanted to talk to you is, in addition to your prolific work as a designer, which I'm in awe of, there's music and there are guitars filtering through on your Instagram and references when I hear you on other interviews. And I kind of want to know, you know, A, how you got to where you are now as a designer, but where the music kind of intersected as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a fun one. I do a lot of these podcasts, right? And, you know, sometimes it's sort of like, what are you inspired by? It's the same old shit. And I'm good at, you know, mixing that up so it's fun for me. And then also being a good little podcaster for the person asking the question. But, you know, to go all the way back, I come from a mom who always had cool shit playing or, you know, something on the record player or the tape player or whatever, and was sort of aware of why, you know, like I was aware at a young age who Neil Young was or why I liked Joni Mitchell or Crosby, Stills, and Nash was like, you know, I'm 6 years old at this point, you know,
yeah.
always had the radio on, had records and stuff and just media. And like my mom was, you know, still buys things, and I'll go home and she'll have a stack of some new stuff that I've never even heard of, you know? And I just, you know, that's awesome. And nevertheless, you know, like, you know, you're 10 years old and you buy your first record. For me, the first record was Quiet Riot. Metal Health, you know, I was 9 or 10, 1983. And that just started this whole thing where that's, you know, someone turned me on to that. And then you have an appreciation for not only the rock and roll, but also the record cover and how dangerous it was or how cool it was. I remember, you know, Def Leppard Pyromania was all this awesome type and color and this surreal image and just all this kind of shit, you know, and it's like, I had an appreciation from a very young age, and, you know, seeing my mom put her records away or have a stack of things like taken care of, well, I knew how to take care of, you know, my tapes throughout high school. And these were treats for me. They were treats. It's like, if I worked, I had a job since I was 13, a pizza job, I'd get my paycheck and I would go buy a couple tapes. And that might've been a Metallica, and it might've been, you know, a Misfits or a Black Flag or punk rock, you know, from skateboarding. I was introduced to, well, band names and t-shirt graphics and dangerous stuff. And, you know, through that, you get the license to say, whatever the fucking jocks are doing, who cares about those guys? We have our own bands in skateboarding and snowboarding and just punk rockery. We have, and it's not about spiked hair, because I never had any of that shit. It's more about thinking for yourself. It gave us the license to say, we can go get all the bands we want. And by the way, you can start your own band and you can learn your own instrument. So at 17, I got my first bass guitar and I had just enough of an ear to be able to play along with a Dead Kennedys song and learn, you know, and get the beat down. And, you know, sure, wobbly, but to this day, I can pick up a bass guitar and kind of keep up with the band. Now I can't go boo doo 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 ba da ba ba ba, but I can play note by note and just keep up, you know, and I'm, you know, and anticipate the change and so on. But that started when I was 17, and all tied in with art, all tied in with, you know, these tiny little rewards for, like, yeah, here's your pizza job, you pay for your car insurance with this, what's left over, you get to buy two tapes. And, you know, I kept all that stuff. You know, I kept all my CDs, and now I have a wall behind me with about, it's about I think it's 5,000 records or something, my entire record collection, which could always thin the herd a little bit. But, you know, this goes all the way back to like, kind of like work your job and then reward yourself, you know, and then appreciate, you know, why this record cover was special for the context it was made in, or how lucky you are to have it, because, you know, the fucking Flaming Lips in 1992 or whatever, when I got to them, they were obscure and weird and not written about and beautiful to me. And the art was beautiful and the music was my favorite to this day, you know, these things. And, you know, the Dinosaur Juniors and the things that unlocked something in me, like, not only was the music so exhilarating to me, but they had complete control over their graphics. Whereas, you know, Jay Mascis, in his infinite weirdness and uncomfortability and awkwardness, the way he picked things was perfect for that music, right? Sure. And then the way the Flaming Lips made their shit, these weird, almost folk art, creepy, lo-fi, freak-out, acid rocker, conservative Oklahoma, you know, sort of place they got to do it, it made it all that much more mystical to me, you know, and awesome. I'm just so thankful I got myself to that stuff, that license to say, I'm going to learn how to play guitar. And, you know, with varying results. Yeah.
Beyond wanting to play guitar, did those album covers influence you in terms of wanting to be a designer?
Oh, of course. Of course. Because you just, you know, the license to say, I get to go try to play guitar was also, hey, I can make my own art for my buddy's band. I can make my own art for our grip tape on our skateboards. I can make my own fake hat company. That's all the DDC is 30 years later. It's just me putting my name on things sometimes and making fun little mugs or whatever. And then out of that came Field Notes, or out of that came the restaurants I help out with, or any of these other vessels, or the typeface I built. I mean, you have to understand, punk rock and records and just the weird stuff out there gave me the license to say, and to not be afraid of just going for it, to shitty results sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, of course, you know, seeing the art and reading the credits and saying, well, what is this? But see, the weird part is now, when you say famous designer, I don't know, maybe to some kid, sure, until they meet me and they realize I'm just a person and I'm cool or nice to them or whatever, and like them. But I remember reading the names like Paula Scheer on certain records when I was a kid on my mom's stuff. And I remember that name. And Paula Scheer is a big, famous graphic designer. I may have met her. I've spoken around her and I've done things. And she's a big name for Pentagram and an icon. And I certainly don't think I'm one of those, but I remember her name. But see, the stuff I was looking at, they had names of like, well, who the fuck is Maura Jasper? That's the name you read in all these Dinosaur records. It was his friend from college, Mascis' friend from college. And he was, you know, I don't know if they were an item. I don't know if they were just buddies. I don't know if they just had an art class together. But it was so awesome that his friend did the art for his records on SST. And I loved it all that much more, you know, because it was down to earth. And it was something that maybe I could do someday. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's what got me into this, you know.
We'll bring this back full circle, because I know you just left Camp Fuzz, the Dinosaur Junior summer camp, and I'll get back to that. But how early on did you know you wanted to be like this was going to be your gig, being a designer?
Well, I loved art, you know, and I loved to draw, and I loved I loved creating. I loved Legos when I was a little kid, but there's a big, you know, a bit of an asterisk. Like, I come from a sort of a, you know, I don't want to say depressed, but, you know, Northern Michigan, there's been some good times. There's been some bad times. They're experiencing, like, it's cool to live in Traverse City, Michigan now. But when I was a little kid, you didn't have an art job in my town. There wasn't. You had to go to Grand Rapids. You had to go to Detroit. You had to go to Chicago. You had to leave my little town and go find these things, you know, and it was instilled in us at a very young age. You're going to have to leave the shitty Midwest and go find the glorious, whatever, West Coast or New York or Miami or the Northwest. And that's where I landed. That was instilled in us from such a young age. And it's like, I forgot the question. You have to clean this up. Say it again. What was the thing?
I was just going to ask you if you knew at a really young age that this was going to be your full-time gig. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So, you know, we're learning how to point where we want to go, but here's the deal. That was some real kind of dicey dreaming. Like I, as a Midwestern warrior and pragmatist and sort of, you know, being very practical about understanding, when I am done with high school, I have to get a job. I had a job all the way through high school. When I am done with high school, I have to support myself and go to college and pay for college. Like, my, you know, my parents covered my community college, but they weren't going to be able to just put me into whatever. I had to go to my local community college in Traverse City. It was always with a sprinkle of, what's interesting about graphic design is you get the buzz of being creative, and then you get a paycheck also. Because I saw fine artists. And not everyone gets to be a Raymond Pettibone or something, you know, one of those sorts of guys, a Pettibone or whatever, you know, that black swag guy. Not everyone gets to do that. That's one of those. But, you know, people who I saw people learning and doing and, you know, exhibiting, they were tradespeople. They were doing, they learned a trade and they went and worked, and that's how they supported themselves. And graphic design felt just enough. So right in high school, you know, I knew I wanted to go into something creative. I could draw. I like to draw. I like to make art and things and stuff. But design was something that made sense. You were always going to need a newspaper. You were always going to need a catalog. Somebody needed to put that logo on that thing, on that roll of toilet paper. You know what I mean? And that to me was functional. And it wasn't about fashion. It was about function. And I you know, There's a safer bet in function. We're going to need those things, and I want to be a part of that, versus almost being indulgent and thinking I'm going to be able to go, well, turn into the monster I've turned into now. Honestly, I just wasn't expecting this. And I'm okay with that. I was okay with a life working hard, saving, going without, because that's what I saw around me. And I saw people do it beautifully, right? So, you know, to get right out of high school and to get into something, you know, the biggest privilege with all this stuff, this has never felt like a job. Sure, I don't want to be working on a Sunday on a logo this afternoon, but also, what am I going to go do? Go to a farmer's market? I don't give a shit about that. I'm going to be working on a Sunday on a logo, making a shit whack of money, stopping every 30 minutes and going and grabbing my guitar and learning whatever I'm listening to, which right now is the new Drive-By Truckers record. Nice. And I might be helping out with some graphics. And Patterson Hood is the sweetest guy, and I'm a fan, and I own all of it, and it's all coming together, and I'm 45 years old. And then what? Putting the guitar down, and, you know, my ears are ringing, and then going back and, you know, noodling on a design and making money. It's pretty cool. This was a hobby well before it was a job. So that comes from being afraid of, like, in a living, stumbling into something that was, I could make a living with, and then, you know, really lock it in and being cool. You have to understand, I come from a place where people sometimes don't like their jobs. Often.
Sure.
The going right. I'm trying to be gentle with that. I don't want to sound too, you know, I've had those shitty jobs, and I will never, ever let graphic design become one of those. I hit a little jackpot, you know? So, yeah.
What was the first job out of college, the first design job?
Well, I went out west at 19 years old. We go all the way out west to be snowboarders and skateboarders, and I dragged my little P bass with me out there. I had a Mexican, you know, like the cheapest one you could get. Sure. You know, that's what I could afford. And I would play along to Super Chunk and Dinosaur Jr. and Swerve Driver and all the other junk I was listening to. And I took that with me out west, and we were snowboarding every day. We were skateboarding. And then, of course, at night, we'd work at pizza jobs and stuff. But about three winters into my 5 winters in Bend, Oregon at Mount Bachelor, there was a want ad for a graphic designer at a local newspaper. And a friend showed me it, and I went down to the thing, and the woman gave me an ad and said, take this ad, sit down at this station, redesign it. And I did. And I walked back with the ad, and I handed it back to her. And she kind of said to me something like, no, I need you to redesign it. You know, like, I need you to rebuild it. And I said, but I did. But I built that shit one to one. And she couldn't quite tell. The prints were, I mean, I did what she asked me to do. And I got the job on the spot. And that was at a nickel ads, what they call nickel ads. Sure. That was in Bend, Oregon. And I was a graphic designer. And I would have to go deal with big, badass, hillbilly, you know, good old boy ranchers and shit who wanted to sell their you know, like, big cowboy Cadillac or a big trailer of some sort, something to hold horses or hold, I don't even know, farm equipment and shit. I knew how to handle those guys. I learned that from those guys and how to be accommodating with some tough characters. But that was my first job. And I, you know, it was a shitty little hourly wage. And I remember one of the guys got let go, and there was a bit of a, you know, a little bit of a Watergate situation there, and he got let go, and then I took over his job. And I remember I was doing twice the work. I could handle the load. I was doing twice the work, and he gave me 25 cents more an hour. And I remember being like, you know, I'm doing twice the work. And, you know, just being bittersweet, right? But it was my first job, you know? That was my first sort of like, you know, where I'd go in and have to like, couldn't wear a t-shirt. You know, I'd go in and just, you know, work. You know, and that was awesome. It was a great, you know, what it did was it allowed me to use their computers after I got all my shit done. I could multitask, and I had me working on my own shit, making logos, making things, making posters for buddies' bands, making record covers for buddies and friends and things and business cards. And I had access to a machine. Up to that point, I did not have a computer, didn't have the funds for that shit, and had to sneak into a community college to use their stuff. Now I have a machine. I didn't have my own. So that next summer, I went to Alaska, washed dishes all summer long, couldn't take my bass up there with me. And that summer I bought a $200 Fender. I think it was called a DC-10. I just remember this number or whatever. I was so proud that I bought a guitar that had like a number. It was a couple hundred bucks. Still have it. And, you know, played that thing for I'm looking at one online right now. They're $149. And I played that thing for about I bought it in 96, and I bought my first real Martin with my first real money in 2006. You know, and I've had that ever since, a D35. And I play that every hour. I play that. So, anyway.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to
answer. They even answered the question.
You did, and then some. You answered my next few questions. From that nickel trader job, you ended up designing a magazine, right? A snowboard magazine.
So what I did was I went up to Alaska. I get the computer. The computer allows me to have, back in the winter, I don't have to work pizza jobs anymore or nickel ads. I can be a freelancer. I do that for a couple more winters. I start seeing, you know, into the precipice of like, there's a cap to what you can do in this little ski town.
Sure.
And it's only going to go this far. And how do I elevate myself out? So in 1998, I go start fishing for schools, and I get a big scholarship in Minneapolis. And now I'm in the big leagues of design. I couldn't afford it, but they allowed me. I got a big ass scholarship. I got in. You know, I went to art school in Minneapolis. I threw away all the West as far as, you know, like snowboarders and snowboard culture and skateboards and sideways shit. Threw it all away. And I went back there and started to see bands that, I mean, we've seen a lot of bands in Portland, but I got to see a lot of bands in Minneapolis. Also got to, like, you know, really fall in love with, you know, your Sunvolts, Wilcos, old 97s, Richard Buckner's, Bottle Rockets, you know, this kind of folkier stuff. At the time, for me, the natural progression was, of course, I bought the first Modest Mouse record right when it came out in the Northwest in, what, 94, 90, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I loved all that shit. But when I went back there, it was okay to let some of that stuff slide a little bit. And I was interested in the Jayhawks and these guys playing, you know, these, like, it was just like the wood was different. I was looking at different wood, and it sounded, you know, Sunvolt's Trace is one of my favorite records of all time. But anyway, I go back to art school. I get armed, and it's not even the latest contemporary hot shit tricks. Oh, they taught us all that shit too. It was more the confidence of like, I can go work anywhere now. I know I can. I've got the chops. Coming from my Midwestern, whatever you want to call it, you know, like underdog status or at least spirit that I always was felt kept by, you know, you don't dream too big because you're not allowed to. And then you just kind of wrap your head around, I'm going to be working the rest of my life. Well, wow, if I can go get trained and get the piece of paper from art school, I can work a better job the rest of my life. And that's exactly what I've done. But it also showed me that there were indie things like my heroes, House Industries, Charles Spencer Anderson, T26, all the guys from the 90s. I wasn't into all the riffraff, puke all over a page. You know, here comes a big F word, fashion that was going on then. I was into function. And these guys had just the right sprinkle of art and unfuckwithability, you know? And those are my heroes. And that's what I was learning from. I got to know some of those guys, got to work for Chuck Anderson in Minneapolis. Okay. I get that out of the way. Now I'm 27 years old in 2000, took my first job at a snowboarding magazine. and shithole Southern California. No offense to all your listeners, but it wasn't for me. You know, I'm not a man of the beach. I'm not a man of traffic. I'm not interested in the chance or surf trunks or even water, for that matter, even going outside. I'm not really interested in that. And here I was in this seething, you know, I-405, I-5 nightmare where you have to drive. I remember having my cruise control at 88 miles an hour and being on the edge of tears, not scared, but more just like, I don't want to live like this, you know? So I did that for 2 years at a magazine, got my ass back to Portland, cut everything in half. I don't drive more than 45 miles an hour in Portland, Oregon, ever. And it's awesome. And I made more money and my rent was cut in half. I had more time for, you know, things and stuff and less time for driving. But my first job was at Snowboarder Magazine. That was my first real, like, you have a salary and things and stuff. I made $37,500 and within 1 week realized I was going to be broke. And I had to go back to the magazine guys and go, if you can't get me to 50 grand, I'm going back to Minneapolis and making 50 grand. So I have to have, because of this way I had at least a couple hundred bucks left over a month, you know,
sure.
Cause it was just, I couldn't do it down there. Anyway, that was 2000.
And then you moved to Portland for a job or just because it felt like home at this point?
Well, it was home. It felt way more like home. I mean, I hadn't lived in Portland up to that point. We had gone to Portland tons to see bands when we lived down in Central Oregon, of course.
Sure.
But I got an offer and it was my shot to get the hell out of Southern California. You know, you get down there and it's beautiful, sure, to someone's set of ideals. To me, what was beautiful was the 400 Club, Lee's Liquor Lounge, the entry, and all the shit in Minneapolis where I could see bands. It was gritty. It was the home of these ghosts, these replacements and Husker Du. Now, I know it wasn't fashionable at that time to talk about that shit in 99. I got made fun of for it, but I loved that stuff growing up. So, you know, I was young for it, but you could still smell the ghosts of that stuff. And it wasn't pretty. And you could be big or be weird or be in whatever in the Midwest and hide from that shit. And you come out to this really fast, progressive place. And it just was really hard for me, you know, like, I don't really give a shit about the sun, you know, or who's coolest or who's the bestest or who's what, you know what I mean? The
sure.
rat race. And I got that job. And when I got this offer to get the hell, see, you get down there and it hurt, but I'm a good Midwesterner. I finished my job. I can't let them down. You know, I can't be this guy that gets out there and just says, I got out there. I was headhunted by an awesome brand 2 weeks into my time out there. And they offered me a job 2 weeks into my time in this for more money in a different town down the beach somewhere. And you know what? I said no, because my allegiance was with my buddies. And they gave me this job and they gave me 50 grand a year to work. And I did my job. And I told them I'd do two cycles. So I did 2 years down there, got an offer, got back to Portland, worked with this, you know, this incredible group called Cinco, and had my first real agency experience where you're like, you know, cool chairs and, you know, meetings and like professionals and like making money. And I remember, you know, I made 60,000 a year and I had money to say, and I could afford things in Portland. And I did that for 2 years and learned also about, you know, meetings about meetings and emails about emails. And I remember one time, one of our clients, and I don't need to name names or whatever, but yelled at us on the phone, not necessarily me specifically, but yelled at a group of us, yelled on the phone. And I remember just thinking, fucker, selfishly, we like to think that we made you a millionaire. You're a millionaire. No millionaires are allowed to yell at the thousandaires, because I was just a shitty little thousandaire, right? You're not allowed to do that. And that's when I realized, fuck this, man. I'm going to go on my own. And I did. And since 2004, I have been independent. I've been profitable as shit. I've worked with my friends. And I haven't had a penny of debt since 2011. So, yeah.
That's great. One of the amazing things about you is that most designers, at least the designers I normally speak to, are pretty specialized. They're book designers, they're logo designers, they do product stuff. You've done all of that. I'm curious, do you love one thing more than the other? Would you rather be making more postage stamps than you know, setting 10 pages of a story.
Oh man, the last podcast I did, we talked about print. I miss it. I miss making magazines. I miss taking a ton of stuff and transforming it so it's easy to read and enjoyable to read. Like, so, you know, I like your mag because that model isn't about shoving things down your throat. It's about actually enjoying the reading of the product. You know, that's a sophisticated thing. And, you know, I'm not 22 anymore where it's like there's a competition between the photo and the type and the shit. Just do the job. Because that worked in 1965 when you read some Architectural Digest, right?
Yeah.
It still works now. And yet we don't really do that. You know, and that's just different ages. And as you kind of age out of these things, you know, here's the thing. When you get out of art school, you know, we were armed with this sort of entitlement of like, I am this now. And see, when I went into art school, I didn't even know that I was an illustrator. I was into page layout. I love to tinker on the industrial design of things. Sure, it's all design. I was a logo designer. I didn't even know I was a writer. You just learn these things because the license that we had, you know, when you get a piece of paper that says you are a product designer, that can also kind of hold you back. Because when I'm around UX, and I don't know how to make a website, but when I'm around those guys, they love to remind me that I am not them. And I just kind of say, well, no shit, you're a coder, man. That's a whole different ball of wax. But even this, when I'm around a typographer, and I released my first typeface a couple years ago called DDC Hardware, and it's still kicking ass. I'm not a typographer. I was at this type conference, and last year, this, you know, middle-aged 58-year-old fidget comes up to my merch table. I'm selling shit. And he looks at me and goes, well, Aaron Draplin, what is all this? And I, you know, I know where he's going. And, you know, I go, well, that's called a poster. They're flat. You put them on wall. You know, I'm just being an asshole. And he goes, but Aaron, you're not a typographer. What are you doing at a typo? And I go, no, I'm not a typographer, sir. I'm profitable. And then the guy walked off all pissed off. He said, this fidget is working on the 17th cut of Garamond. And I get it. That's fine wine at that point. But I don't give a shit about that stuff. I'm more interested in the people using the first cut and doing something cool with it, you know, versus what, you know, worrying about some minutia and, you know, tinkering over. Well, I run into it with guitars. I run into it with pedals. It is so fucking subjective that it's like, you know, it makes me feel small because I don't know what the hell they're talking about with this and all these jokes and inside jokes. And then like, okay, well then play something. And the guy plays horse shit. It's like, well then I don't care how good his stuff sounds. The kid over here is just banging away on these, you know, cover tunes. It's more fun to listen to that. You know, I don't know what I'm talking about, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just have a curiosity. I think anyone, I would hope every kid that gets to do any of this shit. And because there were no rules of like, you know, when I worked for a snowboard company, I'm not a product designer, but he saw how I would attack how to make a t-shirt. I'm not a clothing designer, but I've made jackets with 50 trim decisions and every one is a design problem. Well, how do you make the thing snap there? And how do you do, let's do this. Oh, think about how your hand, you know, whatever. And suddenly I'm a clothing designer. No, I just, the problems in front of me, it's no different than how you design what goes where, you know, on your record wall or how to put, I'm learning about pedal boards or how to put stuff away and be efficient and think about the movement of your body through your shop, my little shop in my backyard here, how the recycling goes out. I know how to do it now. You know, the stuff moves a certain direction. By the time it gets to this corner of the shop, it's ready to go into the little bin. And I get little gold stars from my, the trash guy, you know, because you know, I cut my shit down. I don't mix it all up. I'm proud of that. You know, that's a design problem there too. So, you know, when people ask me what I do, I mean, I love to say to them like, well, you know, they use the E word. You're an entrepreneur. It's like, I don't know about that. I make stickers and sell them. And I guess that's a little business. Or I make logos. I'm working on a big logo. I make record covers. I make catalogs. If they need a catalog, I don't do as much of that anymore. Or I could just help consult someone who's got a lot of great momentum and it's getting away from them. I do that sometimes too, graphically, you know, so all the above until I have to go and put my tail between my legs and go and say, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, web-based. I don't know what I'm doing. Help me, accountants. Help me get out of my, you know, I don't want to be in trouble with my taxes. Or going to have guitar lessons for the first time in my life a year ago and how it opened a lot of doors. It's been awesome.
Let's talk about that. So what was finally the breaking point? What was the decision process in terms of finally taking lessons?
Well, a friend of mine kind of threatened me. He said, God, you know, every time I come in here, you know, you noodle on the same shit. Well, right. I've taught myself this stuff. But he's like, why don't you go take a lesson from this friend? And the friend was a guy named Pete Krebs. And Pete Krebs was in a band called Hazel back in the day here in Portland.
I saw them many times.
So how old are you?
I'm 45. I'm the same age as you are.
Look at us. When do you turn 46?
March.
Okay. So I'm October. I turned.
All right.
Fucking eyebrows are starting to hurt. Okay. So you're probably class of 92, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So then you got to see the grunge explosion and the whole da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And were you always Seattle?
No, I was down in Sacramento.
Okay, yeah.
So
great.
Hazel would come with the dancer and, I think I saw him open I think I saw Pete Krebs open for Elliot Smith. I don't know if it was Hazel opening for Elliot Smith.
Sure. Yeah. You absolutely did. You know, I never saw Hazel. I have posters. I have stuff, but I love those records. Those were the bands during the week that we're playing, you know, when they would open up for the larger bands in town, we would be seeing, you know, I don't know, Lemonheads or Monster Magnet or Paw or Swerve Driver or Dinosaurs or whatever the shit we were seeing. That was on Friday night, Pavements and shit. That was the big ones. We'd come in from Bend, Oregon, 3 hours away and see a couple bands and, you know, drive back Sunday. Well, my buddy says, this guy does guitar lessons. You should just go and see. And I completely understand because my buddies who are musicians, they understand how to play. They're musicians. They understand the craft. They understand the anticipation. They understand just the form and just the sort of like math behind it. And I could run my finger up and down the fret and understand, you know, like, well, that doesn't sound right, but I wouldn't even understand why until Pete, the very first day, showed me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, whatever. You know, I mean, just the very, very basics of being in a key of something. I still really don't even understand it because I can noodle and figure out how to play something. But what he's doing, it allowed me to surrender and to go in and say, I'm not going to show you the seven, you know, Wilco parts I learned. I'm not going to show you the goofy little Dinosaur Jr. things I can play along to. Assess me and start me over. Are we even allowed to do that? Because he explained to me in this really, really fun way. He said, you've got to the gate. You can strum along to any Willie, you know, any Outlaw song, Waylon, you know, Kris Kristofferson, Johnny K. You can strum along. You can figure out those are cowboy chords, baby. You know, I'm going to let you into the gate. And now you're going to start to understand how, you know, these notes work and how to find things. The first day we just went and found, you know, I remember, you know, he showed me how to find the G all over the neck. And I kind of understood that, but only from a sound perspective, like just a, you know, like, oh, that's the right note. But now I can go find my place somewhere and then go and make another little part of that. And I don't even know if it's the right way to talk about it, but I'm starting to figure out guitar solos now. I'm starting to understand, no. I'm listening to this thing. I grab my guitar. This must need a capo because there's no reason why they would play this. So I put it on. And then I realized, no, that's the way they play it because it's comfortable, right? You know, and that's some interesting fuckery for me because, you know, he's teaching me how to play these chords now that sound like Lamb Chop songs. They're jazz. I want to say a jazz chord. I don't know how to say it without sounding like I don't even know what to call them. But they're things that sound without fumbling too bad here. It's I don't know how to. And within one place on the guitar, they'll show me how to play like 11 little, and it's just, you know, with your ring finger, middle finger, and pinky, the little combinations, and suddenly you're getting into this territory, which is just, I don't know, it's really, really fun for me, because I would have been cool just playing, you know, I don't know, you know, EA, you know, like stuff in that zone, up in those first three frets. So my friend who's patient and an incredible musician, I use that word sparingly. My buddy Pete Krebs is a fucking musician. You know, he knows how to play. I am a serial noodler who can learn and then forget and love it along the way, you know, and that's okay. It's like therapy, you know, it's fun for me when I'm designing some bullshit to stop, whip around, grab my guitar, and then noodle and learn something, put it back and feel a little better, and then, you know, dig back in. You know, there's something soothing to me about that.
Sure. Do you have a routine with him? Is it once a week, once a month, or just whenever you guys have time?
Well, he was busy this summer. I kind of dropped off this summer, but, you know, it was every now that I'm in my backyard, I can get over to his place quick. And we were going once a week. And, you know, I always left a little tip because we wouldn't even play guitar sometimes. We just sit and talk about bands and music because I devour this stuff. First of all, I'm a fan. The first day I made him sign my records, my Hazel records. And that's always uncomfortable and awesome. And, you know, what do you want me to say? It's like, that's your job, man. Because now when I sign field notes, I know what to say. I fuck with the kids and it's fun. But, you know, I made him sign his records, man. You know, you have to understand, I'm a fan. So for me to go and pay respect to him and say, here's all your 7 inches and all your stuff. I'm a fan of Hazel. I own all this shit. I went and collected it out of my stuff. I want you to put your dot on it because you did something that is unattainable to many, many people. You made output. You work awesome. I love those records. And you had a following. You were in documentaries. You were in things and you went and did it. Whether or not you made a buck, you did it. There's a lot of people that will never build a field that's like, I mean, I kind of know what it's like now to go and have a crowd mess with you or laugh at you or laugh with you, or you hit a high note and they soar with you. And this is just me talking about graphic design. I mean, I know I'm a big, you know, I talk way too much, but I kind of know what that's like. It's not with a guitar strapped to me. It's showing them, you know, a reaction to something I got to work on in a fun way. I know what that's like now. He did that. I got to do that. I'm really thankful. But, you know, when I meet rock and rollers and say to them, you know, really look them in the eye and say, you know, what a privilege you let me work on your records, like to design their record, because I think I kind of understand pretty clearly that you're probably only going to make about 8 or 9 of these things probably in your life. You know, not everyone is, what I love so much about the Flaming Lips, they have reached multiple record. They have accomplished multiple record deals with the Warner Brothers, right? When I was a kid and you started to hear things from buddies, well, we got a little record deal from so-and-so. They made us, you know, we had to sign on for 2 records. We got through the first record. We did well. The second one, we bit off more than we could chew. They ended up owing money. I've heard that story a million times. And it's like record company, you know, fuckery, you know? And then they end up, you know, they can't recoup the cost. They owe money. And then the band breaks up and then they're in trouble. And that's how this shit just goes, you know? And it's like when you see a hero of mine complete that many records, you know, now when a Bob Mould record comes out, or a Lamb Chop, or whatever I'm listening to, or Mark Kozlik, or whatever I'm into, every one of those is a triumph to me because I know how hard it is to come up with this stuff and then produce, you know, and then have nice art. So when I work on a record for a rock and roller, it's a really special thing because, you know, or work on a book cover for someone who's writing a book. It's like, there's only going to be about 50, maybe 15. Sure, the Flaming Lips did 40 of them. Guided by Voices does one every 2 weeks. But they feel like that. And I love that about it. I own, I've got 40 Guided by Voices records and fucking whatever it is, Circus Devils and all the other shit they do, you know, Fading Captain bullshit. I own all that stuff. But, you know, the guys that are in it and they have to carry a band along with them, I know how hard the pressure and how much they don't make. And then I got to do their record. That means a lot to me, you know? And I say that to all those guys. Thank you for trusting me with this thing because, you know, your little brother could have done it and it looked like it. And when you let me do this for you and I became your instrument, hopefully I realized what you wanted it to be for you. You see what I'm saying? It sounds kind of grandiose, but it's like, you know, I don't know. It means a lot to me. I mean, it's all tied into this stuff. You know, for me to sit with a rocker and watch them play their song they just wrote, that is some of the most magical shit I've ever been around, you know, because sometimes they don't like what's on the record. And I kind of know what that's like too. You know, like when I made my book, and my book went out into the world, oh, there was a lot of changes we wanted to do, but it's out there. And when I hear rock and rollers say shit to me, like, I don't even listen to my records, that always hurts me, you know? It's like, that's your output.
Yeah.
That's your offering. What do you mean you don't go back? And yes, you do. Don't lie to me about it. You bet your ass I go look at my book. I can't believe I even got to make it, you know, that kind of shit. So when I tell them, like, when I'm working on your record, I don't care if there's any money involved. Let's just make it as awesome as it can be. So when you look at it in a couple of years, first of all, it looks different than the other records. It was for the spirit of what you were going for. And then hopefully it sounds good. You know, that's up to me now. I'm the fan who devours that shit. Anyway, what the hell was even the question? I don't even remember what the question was.
Oh, we were talking about Pete Krebs lessons. But now I want to ask you, you just came back from that Camp Fuzz, the Dinosaur Jr. camp. What was that like? And how much, like, guitar instruction was there versus just, like, goofing off and hearing Jay Maskus tell stories?
Well, there wasn't any guitar instruction. And of course, with me, I took a little mini pedal board. I took one of my jazz master. I took a tiny little orange amp, so I could at least hear a little bit of, you know, noise. It's a little orange, you know, toy amp, the little thing on your desktop amp thing.
Yeah.
So I could at least play in my little cabin I was staying in and hear if I learned something. I didn't know what to expect. Like, it would be over my shoulder saying, bend it this way. There wasn't really any of that. What it was fun, number one. I am a fan of Dinosaur all the way back to my adolescence. I got Bug, right? And I was, you know, 15, and it was awesome. I mean, Freak Scene, of course. Well, I've been a fan for 30 years, and I've seen them many, many times. And Jay's combination of awkward and combination of, you know, savant brilliance with the way he plays and the way, you know, and then to go be close to that, you know, 4 years ago when I got to work for them and do a poster for their 30th anniversary, that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool. And, you know, he picked me from, he came to one of my pop-ups. He saw my posters, knew my name, saw my shit. You know, of course I was beside myself that he came to, you know, my pop-up, but it was, I know his guitar tech, you know, one of his buddies. I know, he's a friend, from a friend. And then Jay's really good friend. And, he brought him by, and it was just as simple as that. And this is one of my all time rock and roll heroes. I mean, who are your heroes? Right. And to kind of, I don't know him, but I know him enough now where, you know, say one time, you know, and of course I remember every word he fucking said, because I'm a fan. We were in Detroit at Third Man Records in the backstage, and we were mumbling to each other, and I'm freaked out. And he says, "So Draplin, are you still in Portland?" And I got to tell you, I almost started to cry, because he knew who I was. I don't even know about graphic design. He knew me as a fucking person, not just one of the fans screaming and whatever in the crowd. It fucking was the best. And I was like, wow, I'm 43 fucking years old. He's whatever it was, you know, this was only a couple of years ago. And it was the coolest thing ever, because, you know, I know David Yao enough now to, when he sees me, he remembers me. The Jesus Lizard is one of my favorite fucking bands of all time. Today, I'm going to be working on a record cover for Patterson Hood with the Drive-By Truckers. And I don't even know if I'll even get it, but I own everything by the Drive-By Truckers. And I love Patterson Hood's solo records, and I've met him. And you know what he said? I'm a fan of you, Draplin. We were backstage at the Rack and Tours. I did some posters for my buddy Patrick and the Rack and Tours. This is a lot of shit. I'm dropping a lot of rock and roll names. I'm sorry.
<all right. laughs>
I'm sorry. Usually I was dropping names, and you were like, who the fuck is that band? Well, it was my buddies, you know. But I've been getting hired for stuff. And then when they meet me and see what a fan I am and bring, you know, I met Patterson. I took all my Drive-By Truckers records and all my Patterson Hood records to he was a DJ at a thing here in Portland. He lives in Portland. And I had him sign all my shit. And I gave him my book and just said, I'm a fan. Thank you. I get to work for Jason Isbell, you know,
mm-hmm.
And he was too busy, like, putting, you know, 45s on this fucking DJ gig at Jackpot Records here. I see him a year later and he says, I'm a fan, man. I've been reading your shit. I love your shit. Could I get your number? 'Cause I'd love you to help us with Drive-By Truckers. My jaw about hit the floor, man, because I don't give a fuck if there's any money. You know, I told him, I said, if I'm lucky that you like what I do for you, whatever you could pay me, just give it to your roadies. And he looked at me, really? I said, yeah. I don't care, man. Give it to those guys. They work hard, man. I know what those guys make, and they don't make enough, you know. Give it to them, you know. And we just had a little high five, and I'm working on that this afternoon. I can't wait, awesome. You know. So, yeah. But, I mean, to get back to this thing, I went to this thing excited to be taught by the master. It wasn't necessarily like that. They had guitar clinics where, you know, they talked about pedals. You know, who knew the action on his guitar was serious? You could put your, almost put your finger in the damn strings. It's probably a good quarter inch. It's pretty weird. Hmm. It's high because he likes to, quote unquote, fight the guitar. Who knew they changed their strings every single show? Because I've met guys, you know, I love to talk tech with these, like, kind of like guitar tech dudes and say, well, what's it like to work for Green Day? I have a buddy who works for, you know, tech for the Green Day for a lot of years. And that's a big goddamn act. You know,
sure.
And you get to see what it looks like and stuff. I love to talk that stuff and take notes. Shit. And, you know, they had Kevin Shields there from My Bloody Valentine, which is so special to me because I don't even consider him a guitar player. I consider him a texture player, you know, or something. And he showed how he used the whammy bar and then played through all this, you know, series of pedals. It was the coolest fucking most uncomfortable thing. And then you get to be around the band. They sign your records. They play a set each night, which, of course, you know, there's 60 of us. You know, 45-year-old middle-aged fidgets standing there with Dinosaur Jr. T-shirts on. It was awesome. But, you know, there's also 15-year-old kids, and they would kind of hog up the, like, jam sessions. You know, you go in and be like, oh, come on. I don't want to stand here. My feet hurt. I'm not listening to it. I Want to Be Your Dog extended jam. But then, you know, I lasted for 3 minutes. I'm not going to get my guitar and try to play along with that shit. Fuck that. Go to bed, you know. And then the next morning you see, you know, Jay moseys in and, you know, plays with these little 15-year-olds. And that's kind of what you're there for. So here's the deal. Whether or not it was like they taught me how to bend a note, I got to know their roadies. I know their management a little bit more, but I became friends with all their roadies. They're all wearing the hats. I'm going to work for them a little bit more next year. And it was, I met a bunch of, you know, other fidgets, you know, who are into this band and know all the little liner notes and shit. That's one of my top five bands. I had to go. And, yeah. You know, I saw Jay and we talked a little bit and it was awesome. And he, you know, I gave him a hat and we talked about, you know, how his family is and how mine is. And it was awesome. He's a human, right? But, you know, you put that guitar on him and I am just enthralled by it. So anyway.
All right. Last, last thing I want to know about is, as a designer and as a guitar person, like what guitars do you gravitate towards? You talked about the Martin and you talked about the P bass that goes way back, but what do you have now?
Okay. This is so fun to answer. Okay. I just bought a Martin 000, something, little parlor guitar.
Sure.
A year ago. And that's at my mom's house. In Traverse City, Michigan. I leave that there. I bought it brand new. I'm not really a guy that's really interested in like old. I went to Elderly Instruments in Lansing. That was on the road trip I went on. I was up in Northern Michigan and I just went down and I just went, you know what? I'm going to go buy it brand. I don't want someone's nicks and ticks, right? I don't want their, you know, I feel like a poser doing that or whatever. I don't know if that's the right word. I just feel I want to own this. I have worn the shit down on my little Martin, you know, my D35.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought that one to be back home. And then also what I have back home is I have one of those Guild Thunderbird reissues.
Sure.
The Korean ones. That's an electric guitar. I have, because I saw when I met Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys from my buddy Patrick Keeler, he had the real deal there. One of these like $20,000 Guilds or whatever the fuck. Well, I got one for $550. It's awesome. You know, it's got all the neat knobs and shit. And that's what I play when I'm back in Michigan. Just when I'm noodling at my mom's house and learning songs, when I'm back, I'll be there on Wednesday and I need something to play with. Okay. I'm excited to go be around those. Out here, I've got my D35 an arm's length away. Had that for, you know, 13 years. I've got, I guess it's a 65. It's a 2015 65 Jazzmaster Aztec Gold American Standard, whatever the hell it is. That's okay. What I play, you know, all the time. Upstairs, you know, put away, I've got a Japanese Telecaster. It's an 88, and it is awesome. And that's, you know, my friends helped me buy that. I think it was about $1,000, and that thing is incredible. But it hurts me to have it put away. I've got a reverse Thunderbird copper Gibson up there. I've rarely used it. It's just one of those things. I was in a shop and said, I'll just take it. How much is it? $1,300. I'll take it. Wrap it up, you know? And I took it home. I barely have even touched it. It was just such an awesome, beautiful thing to me. I've never been in a position where I could just go and say, I'll take it, you know? I've got a number of D. Armand, when I couldn't afford the $20,000 Gale Thunder, you know, what is that? Thunderbird, whatever that is. I couldn't afford that thing. The Jetstar Guild, whatever that is. I couldn't afford a real one. I didn't need a real one. I found these D'Armonds for $300. I've got a green one. I've got a maroon one. And I've got a black one in the bass, in the four-string bass that I play Melvin songs to and shit, you know? That's upstairs. What else do I have? I have my original P bass up there, which is a Mexican, you know, a P bass from 1991. I bought that thing. What else do I have up there? I have, you know, I got to work for Fender last year. And the guy said, I did a poster, and he said, hey, let us get you a guitar. I said, what are you talking about? Let me tell you about all the guitars I have. You know, I have seven. I have too many or whatever it is. And he said, just what do you need? I told him, I said, I don't really, I played the shit out of this, this Jazzmaster I bought a couple years ago. And he said, well, let me send you something. What do you want? And I didn't know what to get. And I was so freaked out. Then I did a poster for the Meteora. And it was just, I would rather have that get into the hands of someone who exactly wanted. I felt bad taking one of those. So I just said, Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run album cover. Just one of those Telecasters. And he sent me one. And I gave it to Pete Krebs because I didn't need it. You know, it was too much to handle. When I did this little art and design video for Ernie Ball, they gave me one of those Ernie Ball St. Vincent guitars.
Yeah.
It is the coolest fucking thing. It's in a case upstairs. I don't know what to do with it. It's enough for me to actually have a Jazzmaster in my 45th year. Of course, I've been on the road for years. And when I go into a guitar store and I see the ones that are $3,500, $7,500, $10,000 up on the wall, and there's nicks and chips and dents and things, and do those play better? And I hear all this esoteric shit, like there's ghosts inside this guitar. You can just hear how the thing, I don't know about that stuff. Someone else wore through that thing, you know? Someone else wore through that. That's not my pattern of wear. Mine looks brand fucking new because I'm careful with it, you know? Every now and again, I ding it on something. But nevertheless, I'm not really, maybe I could afford one of those real, you know, 1962 Lake Placid, whatever the hell, Jazzmasters, and maybe someday. But I have to say, when I went and saw Maskus, he's got one of the Squire, you know, models up there.
Yeah.
Plays the shit out of that thing. And then what we learned in his little chats with us is he only plays Jazzmasters who are easy to play on stage. That's it. When he's the guitar, or I don't know how to say it, in the studio, he plays with guitars that are easier to play, Telecasters and so on. That's what he records with. That's what he told us. And he records with one Strat that he grew up with. And it was like, what? So then, you know, the look maybe is like, maybe what, I don't know. That's what he plays. They take a beating or something more. And that's what he plays with those old, you know, those old beat up Jazzmasters he's got, which are just, you know, the classic sunbursts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy's had like, he's had like a lot of different ones, I guess, you know, like tons. I've had two, you know, I have a 2006 Seafoam reissue something or other. And there's some little, like, I don't even know what the little acronym is. It's like ZCM, that's something in Salt Lake City. ORMI, some acronym for like American Standard or something, right? I've got one of those. And I just go back and forth. If I want to play the green one, I pull that one out. I just had a buddy put a Mastery Bridge on it, you know, because my buddy came over here, a guitar guy a couple of years ago, and he goes, what are you doing with this stock, you know, Jazzmaster? And I don't even know what he's talking about. I said, what the fuck, what's wrong with it? If you know what you're doing, you'll get a Mastery Bridge. So I had some credit with my buddy who's a luthier in town here. And while we're talking luthier, East Side Guitars, my buddy Ryan, awesome guy, awesome work, does stuff here in Portland. And he helps me when I need help getting what they call setups. I didn't even know what a setup was. I didn't even know you needed that shit. Now I don't really know what it is, but, you know, I had him done. And he put a Mastery Bridge on my green 2006 Jazzmaster. And this summer I played my gold one. So I need to go have a setup on this one again and then get one of those new, you know, they're cool, but I have credit with them. So he pops for that $200 part. And, you know, all I know about the Mastery Bridge is I saw it up close when I saw Nels Klein play. That was cool.
That's all you need.
That's all I know why they're cool. Yeah. That's all I need. You know, I saw it in your magazine. That was cool. Like, oh, he's got one of those. And man, what a fucking force that guy is, man. What a force. We just did a Wilco six pack with field notes.
Nice.
Anyway, I'm talking too much. Reel me back in, man.
No.
Reel me back in.
Are you writing songs?
Not even close. But what I do is if I stumble onto something, I get my iPhone out, and I've only posted a couple indulgent, look what I learned, you know, things on my Instagram. Because it's weird, you know. I don't, you know, I mean, I learned Dinosaur Jr. songs and I forget them. And I'm happy with that. But it's like, a couple times I've stumbled into something, I got my iPhone out, and then I went and mapped out in a little file where my fingers were. Because I don't know how to go and say, like, you know, so what you do is I just built a fretboard and put, you know, like, you know, finger one, two. I mean, I know how to read tab shit, you know, and then just get the basics down so I can go and connect those things with the file name, you know, from the little recording I made. And then I don't forget it, you know. I had a friend tell me, no, on the top of your guitar, put some little piece of paper like Bob Dylan did, and he would like have his songs on there, you know, and shit. And it's like, whoa, that might be the, maybe I should do that. You put a piece of paper, you can write all your stuff. So you can look down and go, oh, let me, you know, I can play this riff. But, you know, I don't know. This is definitely, you know, enthusiast. I had uncles who could play guitar, and I was always too young and I was never allowed to touch their guitars, you know? So there's a little bit of like, oh yeah, look what I learned when I go home now, you know? And, you know, look at this little bit of music theory Pete tried to teach me. And I don't know, but it sure does sound good. You know, like I get to kind of rub that in their faces. So those fuckers have been playing the same goddamn things all my life. You know, I mean, I love it. I know the songs and stuff, but you know, it's like, yeah, you know, I love my Uncle Kevin and my Uncle Pat and my uncle, and my, you know, my Uncle Mike, you know, these guys, it's awesome. Those are the guys that gave it to me, you know, to be interested in this stuff.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Aaron, I feel like...
Am I doing okay in this thing? Am
you're
I doing okay?
Great. I feel like we need to make this like a three-part episode and meet up in person and do the other two episodes, so...
Well, you should come down here and you can leave with a t-shirt graphic or something fun. I mean, do it, you know, I don't know. I mean, don't, you know, I don't... I know these are fun and stuff, but, you know, I honestly, I haven't listened to your other podcasts, so I need to go do that. But I had a really good reaction a couple months ago with this guy named Jim Hanke on this thing called Vinyl Emergency. And it's a fun little podcast. And I went crazy, of course, and talked about the bands and the things. And I can talk a little bit more about records, you know, until you start getting into these guys worried about, you know, this mono Beatles versus this something, something. You know,
plus,
I was
plus,
just,
plus.
Just fucking crazy.
All right, that was Aaron Draplin, Unfiltered. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we'll have TJ Thompson on this podcast. I know you guys will dig that as well. If you want to support the podcast and everything we do, please, please, please subscribe.